This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to an iconic moment early in the original Star Wars movie. Luke Skywalker, frustrated with the direction of his life, steps outside and gazes at two suns setting on his home planet of Tatooine. Oh, Luke, you really should have savored that last meal with Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. But I digress. Today we're going to talk about whether this particular moment of science fiction could have any connection with science fact. The ultimate question here is whether we can find planets capable of supporting life in a solar system with two suns. And our guest has been doing work on that path. Siegfried Egel is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His work is in astrodynamics, and he's the co-author of the recent paper, this rolls right off the tongue, Circumbinary Habitable Zones in the Presence of a Giant Planet. Professor Egel has a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Vienna, and this next thing it might just be the coolest sounding credential of any guest we've had on the show this year. He works with NASA on planetary defense as part of the DART mission, which stands for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. Siegfried Egel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me.
Listeners, we're opening the phone lines for the rest of the show. 800-222-9455 is the number. Does the search for the possibility of Earth-like planets elsewhere in the universe fire your imagination like it does mine? 800-222-9455. This is also your chance to ask an astrophysicist anything. 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. So, Siegfried, I want to begin. Your paper starts by noting that researchers have identified more than 4,000 planets outside our solar system. And it seems a key next question is whether those planets are in what's called a habitable zone in their solar system. So maybe we can start with a definition. What is a habitable zone?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I think like the whole thing is kind of motivated by one of the biggest unanswered questions that we have, right? So are we alone in the universe? Now, this is a tough one to answer, right? So what astronomers and astrobiologists are doing generally is to try to narrow it down a little and be maybe a little less ambitious and ask where in the universe that we know can we expect life as we know it? The habitable zone is kind of a concept that embodies this kind of more precise question. Because when we narrow the question down a little, we can actually look at the environments that we expect or that we know exist around other stars. Is the planet like roughly Earth-sized? Where does it reside with respect to the star? Is it far enough away that the oceans don't boil? Is it like not too far out so that, you know, the atmosphere would freeze and all the oceans would freeze? So we can have all sorts of more precise constraints if we kind of look at life that as we know it. And this allowed us, in essence, to not only like pose more exact questions, but also to identify roughly 50 or so planets that actually orbit other stars that are in this kind of Goldilocks zone where conditions would be just right, you know, to
not too cold, not too hot, just right, the Goldilocks zone. Maybe we can make it a little more concrete for people. What is the habitable zone in our solar system? Is it just Earth?
So that's still an ongoing debate, frankly speaking. It's pretty much around the orbit of the Earth. So as you know, like in the solar system, we have Venus, which is kind of the sister planet to the Earth. But Venus isn't what we'd call habitable, right? So the surface temperatures are really very high. It's not a comfortable environment. You have like, you know, sulfuric acid rain and stuff like this because it's kind of too close to the sun. And we aren't quite sure why, but the atmosphere of Venus is also very inhospitable. And on the other edge, so Venus is too close, but right on the other edge is Mars. So Mars is, there's a debate whether Mars is actually inside the habitable zone of our solar system or it isn't. But the fact is that Mars is a little too small actually to retain the atmosphere. That's another kind of key ingredient. So the planet has to be large enough so that the atmosphere isn't lost over time. I would say like the habitable zone of the solar system is somewhere, you know, like not quite as far in as Venus and almost like to the orbit of Mars.
Okay. So We're talking about, I think scientists call these exoplanets, right? Maybe we can also, before we sort of get into your work, which is latest work, which is specifically on potential of exoplanets in binary systems, in the habitable zone, I should say. There's all these caveats. But how does one go about finding an exoplanet, right? We don't have telescopes powerful enough to directly observe them the way we can look at, you know, craters on the moon in our backyard, right?
That's an excellent question, Brian. So most of the exoplanets that we know of are actually discovered in a very smart and sort of tricky way. So if you imagine that you would like observe a star, like that's really like billions to quadrillions of miles away, it's pretty hard to get the resolution, you know, to see planets directly. I mean, some of them actually are far enough out from their stars that we can see them directly, but most of them are just too close to the star, and especially the interesting ones, you know, in the habitable zone, are so close to the star that the starlight would just obliterate any direct light that we see from those planets. But luckily for us, some of those systems actually have a kind of geometric configuration that allows us to see the planets moving in front of the star and blocking some of the starlight. So this is called like transit, a transit. And this is how most of the exoplanets that we know today are detected. So we kind of monitor the star. And if we see that the starlight drops in a very specific pattern for a while, that's a very, very good evidence. That's very good evidence that a planet is actually just passing in front of the star. And in order to confirm that that's actually a planet, you then need to look at the wobble of the star itself, because, you know, like the star can dim for any sorts of reasons, like a sunspot or some other astrophysical phenomenon. So you have to like use kind of second technique to try and confirm that the dimming that you actually saw is indeed like due to a planet. And these are the kind of the two like main techniques that we use at the moment. It's transit detection, where you actually monitor the light of the star and see whether it dims in a very specific pattern. And then radial velocity, that's the kind of looking for the wobble of the star with respect to its center of mass, I'd say, like just how the light kind of shifts back and forth because of the stellar motion, that kind of is an effect of the planet orbiting that star, to confirm that what we've seen with transits is actually an exoplanet.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an analogy here. Maybe imagine you're standing at the edge of a field, somebody's holding a flashlight on the other side. If somebody passes in front of that flashlight, the light dims for a moment, and you can sort of infer that maybe there's a person there, on the walking between you and the flashlight, maybe. Let's move on. And I should maybe take a moment to remind our guests, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Siegfried Egel, who is at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, works in astrodynamics there. We're talking about some of his latest research into looking for the possibility of Earth-like planets around distant stars, particularly binary star systems. And I want to ask you about, what are the complications of looking for planets in these binary systems with two stars? You have a line in the paper about the idea of the gravitational interactions between the planet and the two stars. And I'd never really thought of this, but I mean, I'm imagining, you know, the Earth is more or less the same distance from the sun, whether we're talking about the course of a day or a year or even over the eons. How might that be different in a system with two suns?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. That's also an excellent question. So we know that the Earth roughly, you know, gets the same amount of sunlight like every day. So that even the Earth's orbit changes a tiny little bit because, you know, Jupiter and all the other planets are tugging on the orbit. And some researchers are actually linking this to the formation of ice ages. So, you know, if the Earth like orbit changes in a way that it's like on average farther away from the sun, that can have huge impacts on the climate of a planet. And now in binary star systems, you know, like the Tatooine analogs, I like to call them, both of them all the time, right? So and the stars are very, very powerful gravitational entities. So the changes in the orbit of those planets can be way higher than what we know from our solar system. And so it's by no means clear that planets in those systems actually are stable enough or have stable enough climates that would allow them to have liquid water on the surface for an extended period of time.
And if no liquid water on the surface, then no possibility of developing Earth-like life. You know, I want to get back to something you mentioned earlier, though, which is this question of how we narrowed our search. And I wonder if there is a sort of human chauvinism here, or maybe like you, I guess you were saying, it's sort of necessary to just to limit the scope in how we are searching for life. I mean, there is a possibility that life exists in some way that we carbon-based creatures on Earth could not comprehend, right?
Oh, certainly. You know, the universe is very, very big. I mean, it's so big that it's hard to grasp, you know, even if you deal with that on a daily basis, how big it really is. And, you know, my personal conviction is that there is, you know, anything you can imagine is probably out there. The other thing, of course, is like as a researcher, as a scientist, you know, you want to have evidence, you know, and you want to falsify some hypotheses. And that's extremely difficult, you know, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for. So this kind of, I wouldn't really call it chauvinism, but the kind of approach that we take what we know exists and look around, you know, whether we find something similar is just necessary in order for us to make like real predictions and real quantitative estimates of what's around us. And it's still exciting, I think, you know, like having life as we know it somewhere else. I mean, that's the kind of the holy grail of astrobiology.
And certainly the basis for most of our science fiction, right? The sort of alien of the week on Star Trek, as an example. Not that they're all going to be bipeds with different shaped foreheads, but I'm digressing again. I want to ask you, in the time we have remaining, your work is based on observations, I understand, made from the Kepler Space Telescope mission. If I remember correctly, that ran out of fuel, ended a couple of years ago. I know there are new observatories in space on Earth, some still coming online. What is the next frontier in this research?
So we are really excited about data that comes from TESS, which is the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite that's been observing, in essence, like the entire sky since 2018. And it's going to do so for the next couple of years. The reason why this is so exciting is it's kind of the successor to Kepler in a way. But Kepler has been looking at stars that are very, very far away. So the systems that we looked at, for instance, they are like 3,000 light years. And that you know, translates to quadrillions of miles, literally. TESS, on the other hand, is looking for nearby systems. So the candidates that TESS is going to produce are really, like, we're super excited about those because they are much closer, so we can study them in much more detail than we can do with Kepler systems.
We're almost out of time. I do want to take a moment, though, before we let you go, to ask you about asteroids, because I just haven't had enough to worry about in 2020 and 2021. But you're involved in planetary defense, as I understand it, as part of NASA's DART mission. Can you just tell us what is that about?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. So the DART mission is actually the first dedicated demonstration of asteroid deflection. So we know like there's tons of asteroids, like remnants of the formation of the solar system out there, and they do hit Earth, like not every day, fortunately, but they do hit it once in a while, right? So one like was big enough to actually cause a mass extinction of the dinosaurs. And we, for the first time as a species, have the capability to not only find those asteroids, but also to do something about one of them, you know, if they come at us, basically. And so NASA is really very, I'd say, like one step ahead of the game. And in order to be sure that we can actually deflect one, they are launching a test mission. And this is exactly what DART is about. So we try to deflect an asteroid for the first time and see what kind of change in the orbit we can actually cause by, in essence, smacking a spacecraft into the asteroid.
What an amazing time we're living in. Siegfried Egil is assistant professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where he works in astrodynamics. Professor Egil, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure.
And that is all the time we have for our program today and this week. Before we go, I do want to urge you to take a moment to go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're actually going to have an artist's rendering of what a binary star system with a water-covered planet might look like. That was produced by NASA as part of this ongoing research from the Kepler mission. You can also subscribe to our podcast while you're there, 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantal Vaca is our engagement producer. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Briel Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.